It is Thursday, March the 14th, and on this day 20 years ago, Vladimir Putin was overwhelmingly re-elected to a second term as Russia's president. And in just 3 days' time, on March 17th in Russia, they'll be heading to the polls once again for another presidential election. We'll see how that one turns out. Kia ora, this is Newsable. I'm Imogen, and this is what's worth talking about. The food parcel service run by David Brown Butterbean Latelli has had to cut help to 500 families. He's in to explain what's forced his hand. New research out today shows just how hard climate change is biting into the snow levels on our ski fields. A Kiwi Samoan surgeon has written her memoir about working in New Zealand's health system and reveals that nothing can prepare you for the working conditions. Plus, the British village suffering a poo storm from above. All that's coming up in a moment here on Newsable.
Newsable takes time and resources to produce. Please support our mahi and visit stuff.co.nz/support.
Dave Latelli's Auckland-based BBM Food Bank is in crisis after funding cuts. He's had to drop 500 families from his free food parcel service and focus on the 200 most in need. But the boxer-turned-TV presenter, Dave Brown Butterbean Latelli, now plans to launch an employment service with wraparound support to get people into work. Now, just a warning, the following discussion will touch on mental health issues and suicide, which could be distressing for some. David Brown Butterbean Latelli is with us now. Can you tell us what happened with the food bank? Why did you have to drop all these families?
Well, we just can't manage. We're just doing the best we can, like all community groups, and I think people, when they see us because of the profile we have, it's just an assumption that we're so well-resourced from the government, and it's just not the case. So it's incredibly hard, but if we didn't cut back, we'd go broke, plain and simple.
Is it the cost of food? Has there been a cut to certain funding you've been receiving? Is there something that you can pinpoint?
Well, I mean, it's definitely the cost of living for everyone, and our demand's just skyrocketed, again, all community groups. But there's just no money. There's just no funding. Mm. So we rely heavily on, our corporate supporters like foodstuffs, donations, which are very hard to come by. And also, we use our own money that we raise through a massive amount of hustle.
And I imagine one of the toughest calls you've had to make was deciding who does get to get access to your service.
Yeah, it's something I've dreaded. I've never really wanted to have to do that, but it's just something... for our, longevity, to be sustainable, we just have to do it, and it sucks. But in saying that, if anyone turns up on our tools, we never turn anyone away. It's more the people that are applying.
And you're having a bit of a refocus at the moment as well, looking at helping people into jobs. Are the jobs out there to support those who are coming to you wanting help?
Yeah, well, we only announced this on Sunday, and had an overwhelming response from people looking for work. And, we'll be meeting with some, great companies. The important thing is the companies that we will be working with align with our values.
Sure.
It's not just, okay, let's just get a whole bunch of people and have them working in a warehouse for the rest of their lives. When they need a job, let's get them into that job. It's a lot better than being on the benefit, but then let's work with them to find out what their goals are and what their aspirations are, and work their way up from there. So we can support them. So the big point of difference with us is the wraparound support that we'll give these families as they get into work and work their way up.
Why is wraparound support needed?
Not everyone has a good friend and family that can help. I put it back, on my own situation. When I moved back here in 2014 with no money, broke, depressed, brokenhearted, wanting to kill myself every single day, I was at least lucky that I still had a good family around me and friends that could help, right? So that's why we do what we do now, because a lot of people don't have that. So we're trying to be that support network to give people who really want to get up out of the situation they're in a chance.
Will this wraparound service that you're offering for people trying to get into jobs, do you reckon that could be a solution for those who are now unable to access your food parcel support?
100%. So this, to us, everything we're doing in BBM is about giving people a hand up. This new venture we're doing, BBM Recruitment, is going to be a genuine way that we can give people a hand up. And I'll just give you a quick example. Our first lady we got into employment, she approached me 2 years ago, homeless, pregnant, and wanting to kill herself. you know, no. So I got her into a place. She followed the work. She messaged me on Instagram. I got her into a place. I paid for her bond. I connected her into our food share so we could support her with food. And then she came and we connected her into our Mums and Bubs program at BBM. From there, she'd done a welding course and we got her a job 3 weeks ago as a welder with Synpro.
Awesome.
So that's the story, right? That's amazing, you know?
Mm. You were also interested or signalled interested in getting involved with the government's boot camps for young people, which critics call military-style boot camps. Research, some research at least, seems to suggest they don't have long-term results. Why do you want to get involved and what do you think you can achieve?
Well, I mean, we already do it. And what this government's got wrong, not all governments, they got it the wrong way around. It needs to be community-led with government services wrapped around that community. Not the other way around. I want to get involved because, like, I'm one of those youth. I've managed to turn it around. We've got people working with us that all, former gang members, former addicts, they've all turned it around. So when we're talking to these kids, they believe it, you know, and we train really hard. The thing about these camps, they're going to go there, these kids are going to be, treated harshly, but they're used to being treated like shit. They're used to that. So how's that going to help, you know? But what they're not used to is being surrounded by love and care, people that care for them. That's what they're not used to. They do all these things for 12 weeks. They go back into the same environment and nothing's been done with the family. Mm. You've got to take the whole family on this journey and understand that it's not going to be popular to say, hey, we're going to help the family so it improves lives for the grandkids. So that's what breaking the cycle is.
And your work, as you've already mentioned, relies so much on community support. How should people get in touch if they do want to support the BBM movement?
They can go to our website, thebbmprogram.com, or just reach out to me on Facebook under Brown Butterbean or on LinkedIn, Dave Latelli. If you can help, please do.
Dave Butterbean Latelli, thank you so much for taking the time to chat from your car, no less. Really appreciate you finding time in your busy day. You can read more about Dave Latelli's plans in a story by Steve Kilgallen this morning on stuff.co.nz. And if you or anyone you know needs help or to speak with someone, we'll have some phone numbers on the Newsable website, newsable.co.nz. Now, yesterday we spoke to Stacey Scott, who was on a mission to try to only spend $5,000 on groceries over the entire year. Now, this story garnered a lot of interest, and especially given what we've just talked to Butterbean about, we want to know what you think. Could you too only spend $5,000 a year on groceries? We'll put a poll up on the Stuff Instagram. Get your votes in. I don't think I could do it, that's for sure. Find us at NZStuff. Scientists are sounding the alarm bells over ski fields and climate change. New research out this morning from the University of Bayreuth in Germany estimates that within the next century, under a high emissions scenario, New Zealand slopes will have lost half of their annual snow cover days. So days where the mountain is sufficiently covered in snow for skiing and or snowboarding and or tobogganing, which we already know is actually pretty dire today. The research also found globally, by the year 2100, 1 in 8 major ski areas will lose all natural snow. Lauren Vargo is a research fellow at the Antarctic Research Centre and joins us now to discuss this further. Lauren, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What are we seeing today in terms of climate change impacts on ski fields here in New Zealand?
Yeah, well, so I guess starting off, it's really wonderful that this study that was looking around the globe included New Zealand. Mm. So many studies are just focused on the Northern Hemisphere. And so based on that, we don't know a ton about what's going on with climate change and snow. When we talk about climate change, we usually think about kind of 30-year averages. But in New Zealand, our snow cover records are only about 20 to 25 years at the most. And so it does make it hard to look at trends over just those short records. So that's why it's one of the reasons why it's really great to have this study, including New Zealand.
Mm, but we already know, right, that our ski fields aren't getting the snow that we would love them to have. Like, if I think about when I went skiing as a child, very lucky to have gone, versus today, very, very different.
Totally. And I, like you, have really enjoyed skiing at Mount Ruapehu when I first got to New Zealand 8 or 9 years ago. And then in the past 3 or 4 years, it's been a lot shorter seasons with a lot less snow. Mm. NIWA makes measurements of snow cover at a few places around the South Island. And I'm just looking at a plot of that from Mueller Hut in Auraki, Mount Cook. And the snow cover this past season was a lot lower than that previous kind of 12-year average that they've seen.
Because this research is looking all the way forward to the year 2100. Goodness me, it sounds weird to say that. But we will be seeing further changes between now and then, right? It's not like that year's going to hit and then boom.
Absolutely, yeah. And so we'd expect to see kind of on average a decrease that corresponds pretty similarly to the warming that we're experiencing. And there might be some really good years, some even worse years in there. But yeah, we know that temperatures are rising in New Zealand and around the globe, and we know that those warmer temperatures have a big impact on the amount of snow that falls.
And this is much bigger as well than just people getting to enjoy a bluebird day, right? The areas in New Zealand that have ski fields rely on them heavily for their local economy.
Absolutely, yeah. And so I know in Europe, a lot of ski fields have been looking at transitioning to doing things in the summer. So mountain biking, kind of other summer activities that they can do to kind of make up for losing that revenue over the winter.
Is the future looking less skiable, less snowboardable, and less tobogganable?
Yeah. So the kind of gold standard for looking at climate change is the IPCC, this kind of United Nations-based climate change report. And the science, the physical science side of that came out a couple of years ago. And they had statements with high degrees of certainty that there will be less snow cover kind of in the future and that there's less today than in the past.
Yeah, not looking good for the toboggan fans out there. Lauren Vargo from the Antarctic Research Centre, thank you very much for taking the time to kōrero.
Thanks so much.
We are just about to meet a Kiwi surgeon who, while studying medicine at university, gave birth on the Monday and then sat her med school exam the following Friday. She is simply remarkable and has some very interesting and frank things to say about the state of New Zealand's healthcare system. So to make sure you never miss interviews like this next one, chuck us a like and a follow wherever you get your podcasts. Enika Meredith is here now to talk all about this. Enika, welcome to Newsable.
Thank you for having me.
You write right at the beginning of the book, as you read this, please remember, I am a very happy person. I just do not think I was prepared. What was it that you weren't prepared for, do you think?
For the heaviness, for the trauma, the emotional intensity and what you carry after years of practicing surgery. And I write in the book, equally nothing can prepare you. You know, we watch Grey's Anatomy and ER and, you know, that's an hour of your life. But what you don't see in those programs is that they go home with this weight on their chest and they lie awake at night and wonder if they could have done something differently. And they see their patients in their sleep and you're not prepared for that.
Yeah, interesting. Because the state of New Zealand's healthcare system at the moment particularly is constantly in the headlines, right? We hear of burnout, underfunding, understaffing, long wait times. The majority of the country's GPs, we found out in recent days, are unable to take on new patients at the moment. Was that your experience too while working here?
Well, yes. I mean, health systems all over, no matter where you are in the world, they're under pressure. And by nature of what we do, it's increasingly under pressure because we've got an aging population, we've got more advanced medicine, people expect more, people live longer. So for all those reasons, there's more pressure, there's more expectation, there's limited resource and just a lot more to do. So on an individual basis, yes, me as a surgeon, working in a New Zealand hospital, absolutely. You know, there are more referrals than we can deal with. There are more reviews than we can see. There are more people who need surgery than we have enough operating lists and probably surgeons, depending on what you need. So, of course, it's this bubbling pot. And something has to give because at the same time, there's this huge expectation to do everything perfectly. And when you're operating like that, maximally stretched every day, something will give.
And how did you cope? You talk about the weight. How did you cope with that weight?
Well, I don't think we have time to cope with that weight, to be honest with you. You know, if you're operating on a Monday and something goes wrong, which you didn't expect and it's horrible, You have until the next morning to get over it, be normal and come back to work and do the same thing again. How do you come back to being a normal person and having compassion for people who are not well, who are demanding, for students who need to be taught, for your colleagues and for allied health professionals, if you can't deal with that?
And that, of course, was while you were in the workforce, but while you were studying, you gave birth to your son on a Monday, I believe it was,
and then had to
sit a med-school exam on the Friday.
Yeah, exactly. So it starts, you know, actually it starts then.
How did you do that, Inika?
Family, my mother. You can't do it otherwise. But I think that actually as women, we kind of just accept that that's okay, and probably it isn't. In fact, it isn't.
Do you practice medicine at all anymore, Inika?
Yes, I'm with my husband, who has a private practice in France. So once a week, I'm working with him, but very much in a private breast cancer and breast reconstruction and no general surgery.
Was that an intentional pullback in terms of what we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, it was time for a change. And also, I just didn't like the person that I was becoming, to be honest. When you're tired, you start to lose compassion, and that's not who I was. And, you know, maybe my son was not recognizing me, and you don't even have time for reflection, you know, and that's really important. There's no time to think. There's no time to just to think, which
to
is
just,
really, yeah, exactly, to just. So, you know, it was time for a change. It really was time for a change.
Inika Meredith, I loved the book, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us from Paris.
Thank you for having me.
Residents in the UK village of Great Gonnaby in Lincolnshire, population estimated at around 2,200, have a poo problem. Specifically the bird poo kind, thanks to tens of thousands, according to the BBC, of starlings, birds that have been forming murmurations at sunset. Murmurations are when they all come together and fly, forming beautiful shapes, which is what the Great Gonnaby locals thought too, beautiful shapes in the sky, until the shit started to fall from the sky as well, covering cars, covering front porches, door handles to your front door. Some people claim they've copped shit on their heads as well. The good news is, according to my basic research, murmuration season seems to run from October to March. But these starlings appear to be late bloomers if we're only just hearing about their mess they're making in Great Gonnaby now, mid-March. The village could be in for a bit more poonami. Good luck to them, I say, and my suggestion is that they all just walk around in those plasticky rain jackets you buy at rainy music festivals. You know the ones. That's Newsable for today. I'm Imogen Wells. Keep your eyes to the sky for any impending poo today.
This pod took time and resources to produce. Please support our mahi and visit staff.co.nz/support.